And tonight on Coast to Coast AM, we will talk the blood gospel. We're going to talk about vampires. How real are they? Stick around and find out. James Rollin joins us next on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back. Let me tell you about James Rollins. Decided to become a writer as a young boy, immersing in the scientific adventures of Doc Savage, the wonders, of course, of Jules Verne and H.G. Wells, and of course, The Shadow, The Spider, The Avenger. Now, Jim first pursued a career in veterinary medicine, graduating from a great school, the University of Missouri, establishing a very successful clinic in Sacramento, California. Hands-on knowledge and interest in medicine and science shaped his work for his books. Here he is on Coast to Coast, James Rawlings. Hey, James, how are you? Welcome back.
Great. Good to have you. Thanks for having
me back. Always a pleasure. You know, your school that you went to, by the way, also has a great journalism school. You know that? I think Brad Pitt went there.
That Brad Pitt did indeed go to University of Missouri, one of the claims to fame of the university.
Jim, I'm barely hearing you. We may have to call you right back.
Okay.
But let's chat for a little bit while we're doing that. What have you been up to since the last year or so, when we were together?
I've got another book coming out besides The Blood Gospel this year. I've got another of the Sigma series. It's called The Eye of God. It comes out this summer. And I've been working on a film tie-in with the Sigma series also.
Now, how did you get interested in the unusual?
Well, you know, growing up, I read Jules Verne, H.G. Wells, a lot of the classic pulp novels from the 30s and 40s. They were reprinted as Bantam editions, and still at this point, I'm looking across my office right now, and I have 181 Doc Savage novels sitting on my shelf. And Doc Savage was an early rendition of my Sigma series. You know, a team of scientists that go out there and look at unusual threats to the country or the world, and they often walk that line between science fiction and science fact. I've always loved playing in that gray area between those two.
It's amazing some of the things we pick up as young children and carry on later on in our lives.
Yeah, you know, I remember reading or hearing at one point that whatever music you liked in high school is the music you like for the rest of your life. So I think there is, you get ingrained about certain things that really excite you, that you're passionate about, and you can never quite escape it.
The cover, by the way, I got to tell you, I've got the not for sale edition of your book that I've been reading, The Blood Gospel. It's a great graphic color. Whoever came up with that for you did a superb job.
Yeah, I really enjoy that cover. I like the moodiness of it, the use of the grays and the reds together. The striking cover.
Now, do you still do veterinary medicine on the side, or are you strictly an author now?
I still do some volunteer work. I work with a group that traps feral cats, wild cats in the local area. They bring them to the shelter, and I spend about 8 hours one Sunday a month spaying and neutering them. It's basically just a hobby, removing genitalia. That's about all I do with my veterinary degree anymore.
Those little animals love you.
Well, we're doing our best to try to turn out those cat colonies that are basically little kitten factories and disease vectors. Trying to do my best.
I had a story earlier about a cat named Holly, and it was basically, it disappeared from its owners 200 miles away from its home. They couldn't find it. They went home. Of course, they were depressed. 2 months later, James, 2 months later, Holly the cat shows up at the house. How can a cat 200 miles away find its way back home? Scientists are baffled about this case.
Yeah, we hear stories about that all the time. And again, I'm fascinated by that, what we call the human-animal bond. As a matter of fact, I've in Bloodline, my last Sigma novel, I have a military working dog. And I enjoyed exploring that human-animal bond because it goes beyond any type of communication. Even the military handlers describe their relationship with their dog by saying that over time, their emotions become so in sync that almost inexplicably, it travels up and down the leash between them. They even have the phrase, it runs down the lead, describing how over time that emotion sort of flows down that leash between dog and handler. So to the point where they don't need to communicate anymore.
It truly is remarkable. Well, anyways, with The Blood Gospel, it's a novel, but it's got a lot of scary facts in there. You've kind of weaved them in, haven't you?
I do. I mean, that's what I love to explore, is that line between fiction and fact. And at the end of all my Sigma novels, I do have a section about what's true and what's not, to try to, because I have tried my best to blur that line between that, so at the end I sort of reveal, not only what's factual in the novel, but even when I extrapolate into the future, what I'm basing that on.
James, let's talk about vampires, and how did you steer yourself into that direction?
Well, it came about, I was actually at the L.A. County Museum of Art, and they have Rembrandt's painting of the Raising of Lazarus. And I've always been a big fan of Rembrandt. I just, for some reason, his dark gothic type of quality of painting always appeals to me. And I kept coming back to that painting a few times when I was visiting that museum. And several things struck me as odd about that painting. In that painting, of course, Jesus is raising Lazarus out of his tomb. It's a wondrous moment. He's returning Lazarus to his loved ones who are in the background of the painting. But instead of those loved ones looking happy about the return of Lazarus, they all have expressions of horror on their face. And I kept looking at those expressions and wondering, why did Rembrandt choose to paint these spectators with such a look of horror rather than any miraculous occurrence that's occurring? And then if you look even closer at the painting, is that above Lazarus' grave, there's a bunch of weapons hanging on the wall. There's a sword, there's a bow and arrow, there's a shield. Now, historically, Lazarus, according to the Bible, is more of a moneylender, more of an accountant. So again, it struck me as odd, is why did Rembrandt choose to paint all these weapons above Lazarus' grave? And even the pose that Christ takes in that painting, his arm is stiffly stretched outward, palm towards Lazarus, which in Roman times was typically the swearing of an oath. Again, it's just a strange pose to paint Christ in. So that got me thinking down a road of, why must he have, did Rembrandt know something we didn't know? Was he trying to communicate something in his painting that he didn't really want to be putting out there blatantly? And it sort of sent me down a path about what if this painting, again, I talked to an art historian who said that, and there's many versions of what this Raising of Lazarus painting done by Rembrandt, the one that's hanging in the Museum of Art at Los Angeles, not the only painting. And one of the art historians, when I was doing research on this, said that some of the earliest renditions of the painting, there's actually blood on the lips of Lazarus in some of the early versions of the painting. So that got me thinking, there's some vampiric overtones to this painting. There's the horror on their faces, the blood on the lips, the swearing of the oath. So it got me wondering, if vampires existed, how might have Christ dealt with vampires in the past? How might that alter what we know and understand about the Catholic Church, about ancient history, about modern atrocities? It sent me on a journey down a path that I think hopefully readers will find surprising, maybe even revelatory. And this sort of building and building and building, and eventually I just couldn't let the story go, even though I normally don't write something that is quite so, for lack of a better term, sort of supernatural. Most of mine is more scientific. I couldn't quite let the story go, and so I started looking about the science of vampires, the history of vampires, and the story got larger and larger and larger. So eventually I just couldn't let it go. I had to write it.
Well, it's a great story, and James, I want you to hang up. We're going to call you right back to see if we can get a better line from you, okay? This is it is so distorted that if I can't get you fixed, we're going to probably have to go to open lines, which is unfortunate because this is one heck of a story about vampires. Our guest tonight, James Rollins, his latest work, The Blood Gospel. His earlier one that I talked with him about last year was called Blood Line, and he's into all kinds of things, but I'm not. Let me see if we can get him back. Let's see what your quality's like here, James. Any better?
I can hear you okay, but not sure the quality you're getting at your end.
No, it's not very good. So I tell you what we're going to do. We're going to talk for about 5 or 6 minutes here, and we'll see if your backup cell phone is any better.
Let me switch to this. Oh, hang on.
All right. What do you have there to switch to? Let's see. Ba-ba-ba-ba.
Is that any better?
It's dramatically better.
Okay.
I think.
A cordless phone, but they said not to use the cordless, so I'm using, it's an older version of a non-cordless phone, so maybe it's just too old of a phone.
You mean the first one you had?
Yes.
Okay. Well, this is a little better. Let's hope it gives us enough juice to get this going. Anyways, so we're talking about the stories of vampires, where they originate, and what's going on. They go way, way back into time, don't they?
They do. I mean, at this point, the actual term of the word vampire only goes back to probably the early 18th century. Around 1745 is the first time you see in the Oxford English Dictionary the word vampire. And the description of that in the dictionary, the preternatural being of malignant nature supposed to seek nourishment or to do harm by sucking the blood of sleeping persons. But of course, there's older versions of that, using the older word of vampire with the ending in Y-R-E. But the notion of vampires goes back to millennia, goes back to the cultures of Mesopotamia, back to Lilith in the Hebrew Bible, to the ancient Greeks, to the Romans. Even Homer, in his epic of the Odyssey, references ghosts consuming blood so that they can speak to the living. And it's probably actually the first real recording of that link of blood between the living and the dead. And then if you move forward up a couple more centuries, but the millennia, we start seeing more historical reports of the living dead around the 12th century. There was an English historian named William of Newburgh, a fascinating guy who was sort of known as a political reporter of his time and also sort of a gossip about the royalty. But he's a well-known historian, wrote a lot of books, but he wrote an interesting account of a man who died from a fall after discovering his wife was having an affair.
From a fall?
From a fall, yeah. He had tumbled off a horse and then died. It was said that, according to William of Newburgh, the fellow rose from his grave and was terrorizing the villagers. And what's interesting is how he describes the discovery, the way the villagers dispatched this undead monster. And I'll quote from here. It says, "The brave young men, excited by wrath, struck a wound in the lifeless corpse from which so much blood flowed that it was understood that he had been the bloodsucker of many." So he wrote this book about around the 1100, the year of 1100. So again, even well before the official definition in 1745 in the Oxford English Dictionary, there are all these accounts. And it's not just him, but there's other historical accounts that were documented by officials, including members of the clergy. There's a French abbot in the early 18th century who reported, and I'll use a quote from his line, "People who were dead for several years or months have been seen to return, to talk, to walk, to suck the blood of their close ones, making them ill or killing them." So again, these aren't storytellers. These are considered to be factual accounts of witnesses experiencing these events.
I hate to be living in that era, let me tell you.
And it's not even just back then. Even here in the U.S., there's about 200 years after the Salem witch trials, there was what's known as the Great New England Vampire Panic, where a couple small villages or towns in New England ended up killing a bunch of people or believed that there was a vampire attack, but it actually dispatching digging up graves and dispatching these victims. So again, we just see account after account. It's not just, of course, on our continent, but you'll find it in Asia, you'll find it in Africa. There seems to be this universal, mindset that there's the undead that come rising from their graves and sucking on human blood.
Is that possible, James? Can there be truly the undead?
Well, I mean, at this point, that's a stretch for me to believe.
Okay.
But but
stranger things have happened.
Exactly. I'm not one to dismiss it. I've done a lot of research about, is that that possibility? If you move into modern times, in 2002, there were allegations of vampire attacks swept through the African country of Malawi, where with mobs stoning one individual to death and attacking at least four others. And then even in February of 2004, several relatives of a Romanian man feared that he had become a vampire, so they dug up his corpse, tore out his heart, burned it, and mixed the ashes with water in order to drink it. And then even in 2005, we were just talking about a few years ago in Birmingham, England, rumors were circulating that there was an attacker biting people that fueled sort of a vampiric concern even then. I did a lot of research about modern vampires. There are certain subcultures that do believe that they are vampires. There's two forms of that. There's some that believe that they're actually blood-sucking vampires or physical vampires. But there's also ones that believe that they are psychic vampires, where they're living off
right.
the energy of others.
Well, we know those kinds of folks. How many of us have been to parties or events and we run into these psychic vampires, some of whom don't even know they are who they are, James?
That is true. And I wanted to also talk to this one gentleman that had an interesting theory about a viral way of triggering vampirism using an endogenous retrovirus.
A virus? Like a flu virus or something like that?
He believes that, and that's one of the reasons why there was this belief in disease passing on, is that you would catch this virus and it would actually cause the retrovirus actually change your DNA. And we know that the retrovirus, the family retrovirus, includes HIV and some other common diseases. But this subculture believes, or this gentleman I was speaking to was describing how he's done a lot of scientific research behind this and believes that there are actually real vampires out there. People are infected by this specific type of endogenous retrovirus called HERV. And he believes that once you're infected with that, it actually alters your DNA and makes you almost superhuman, enhances your strength, your speed, your mental ability, your psychic abilities, and including the ability to digest human and animal blood more efficiently.
That's interesting.
So again, just a lot of interesting things out there. So I'm reluctant to totally dismiss that. I always love to think of what else is out there.
Well, Hollywood has illustrated vampirism. They're petrified of garlic. They can't stay out in the sun. Are these real episodes that occurred in the past, or did Hollywood just make this up?
Well, that's interesting that you should ask that, is that there's, looking at some of the science behind vampirism, how that belief or that mythology or that notion of vampirism might have risen, definitely does seem to have maybe possible roots in reality. I mentioned before that there was sort of an upsurge in the 12th century about these stories of vampirism, and that's about the same time the European countries were being hit by a series of plagues and flus. Now, back then, no one understood about bacteria or viruses, and they were experiencing deaths that were spreading systematically through a house or village. One person would die, then another, and they didn't understand at that time about the incubation period of disease. So when one person would fall, then another, they would sort of fall like a series of dominoes because of the way disease is spread. And to the superstitious back then, it would appear the dead were coming back to claim the living. And when the corpses were dug up and they found the state, where they're bloated and bloody-lipped, people began to maybe believe that these people were actually still alive. And as a matter of fact, that great New England vampire panic I was describing, scientists have sort of investigated the bodies that were being attacked, that they were being dug up and mutilated by this fear of vampires, and then what they found out, it was tuberculosis.
Aha, hold on. We're going to come back more with you, James, on Coast to Coast AM. And we'll be back with James Rollins in a moment as we talk about blood gospel, vampires. Hey, you can send in your editorial to us at editorial@coasttocoastam.com. Make it about a minute. Put your phone number in there. We'll record you and probably use you, we hope, during the show. That's what we do. Listen in.
This is Moshe from New York, and this is my sound off. My dear friends, America is a dying society. Lest you think this statement is too extreme, let me prove it to you with a metaphor. If a person contracts lung cancer and the doctors in charge of providing health care tell him, "Oh, it's just a bad cough. Take some cough medicine and you'll be okay," that patient will surely die. Today, we live in a society where God has been removed from the public discourse. It is okay to teach in our public schools that Johnny has two mommies or Kathy has two daddies, but God forbid, no pun intended, that there should be a copy of the Ten Commandments, which states, "Thou shalt not murder," in the classroom, let alone teach it. The courts have already ruled that it is forbidden even to have a copy of the Ten Commandments in our courthouses. As a result, there is an entire generation of children who have grown into adulthood, never having heard the concept that there is an absolute prohibition from our Creator, "Thou shalt not murder." I can guarantee you that all the regulations against military-style assault weapons, etc., that the government will enact, all the recriminations hurled back and forth over violent movies and video games, will not make one iota of difference in curbing violence in our society unless we return to the basics of morality which our Judeo-Christian heritage teaches us. This is Moshe from New York, and this has been my Sound Off.
And here we go, James Rollins with us, Bloodspell. James, you were talking about the when they would open up a coffin, they'd see a body there bloated with blood all over it. What did they think, that something got into them or that they were the vampires?
They definitely, again, document after document, there's a very consistency in the way they're describing these apparently vampiric corpses. They would dig up these corpses. They found that there was blood on their lips. Their stomachs were bloated as if from a recent gorging. They had fresh-looking organs. They had claw-like fingernails and elongated teeth. And terrified by the sight of these bodies, villagers would oftentimes drive stakes through their hearts or chop off their heads. Even in Venice, a recent uncovering of a mass grave in Venice showed these bodies that had these bricks shoved in their mouth to keep them from biting. And again, around that time, the plague was afflicting Venice, and it was believed that they were putting these bricks in his mouth because they believed that these undead were rising from their graves and biting people and passing on the plague in that manner. And so to prevent that, they'd put the bricks in their mouth. But again, it's very uniform the way they're describing these bodies, with the blood on their lips, the bloated stomachs, the claw-like fingers, elongated teeth. And there's definitely a scientific explanation for the way these bodies were found. Necrotizing bacteria or decay inside a dead body will cause the body to bloat with gas, and then the stomach distends. That drives blood up from the lungs, up the trachea, where it can stain the lips.
Yeah, okay.
Now, of course, the atrophy of the flesh and gums will also make the teeth and fingernails appear longer. And additionally, these gases, when a body is disturbed, they're moving the body or digging up a grave, can cause these gases to move past the vocal cords that can create sound as if they were groaning or attempting to speak. And, of course, really, it's back then that the state of the body found in such a manner led to superstitions and terror and belief that possibly these bodies were still alive, which in very many cases they may have been. There were, again, another belief in the source of vampire mythology was that people were being buried alive. Even today, we're finding here cases of people awakening in the morgue after being declared dead.
Well, in those days, remember the old saying, they called them dead ringers. They would put a bell out, inside the coffin, right, with a string. So if somebody woke up and he was alive in the coffin, he'd pull the bell?
Yeah, that's the other, saved by the bell, the other, common phrase for that description, because it was fairly common for people to be declared dead. There's a classic case then in 1937, a gentleman named Angelo Hayes, he suffered a motorcycle accident. And at the hospital, he was not breathing, there was no detectable pulse, even by stethoscope, they heard no heartbeat. He was declared dead and buried, but an insurance claim required exhuming the body, and 3 days later, they pulled his corpse out of the grave, and they found the corpse was still warm. They found out that he actually wasn't dead. He eventually recovered from his injuries. So again, because there was this not an uncommon occurrence today, it is an uncommon occurrence today, but not so uncommon in the past. So that again, they were equipping graves with these bells to try to alert people that if they did wake up from their apparent death, they could alert somebody that was still alive.
Why are so many people fascinated with vampires? And I want to get into psychic vampires again,
sure,
who we talked about. But, people are fascinated by it. Look at what happens at the movies with Twilight, this series, and, Anne Rice's Vampire Chronicles. And
when I was starting to write this series, when I got this idea, I was a little reluctant to even tackle the concept of writing a vampire novel. And I talked to my editor. I said, the Twilight juggernaut is winding down. I don't know if I should be writing a vampire novel. And my editor said, vampires never truly die, which, I found amusing considering the subject matter of the undead. But she said that every generation sort of reinvents the vampire and casts the beast in a new light. And if you look back, through the literature, you can see that happening. Even going back to the classic of Dracula in 1897, Bram Stoker's monster was an aristocrat preying upon the lower classes, and Bram Stoker was casting sort of a dark mirror upon his own Victorian times, but again, the upper classes were basically sucking the lifeblood out of the lower classes, so it's almost an allegory of its period of time. And that continues on as you move forward. In the 1950s, Richard Matheson wrote a novel called I Am Legend, which became a recent movie with Will Smith. And here they had vampires taking over a post-apocalyptic Earth. Again, they were playing to the fears of the 1950s, which was of a nuclear Armageddon.
Right.
So again, we see the vampire mythology reflecting the fears of that time. Move up to Stephen King's Salem's Lot, one of my favorite novels. Still scares the pants off me whenever I reread that novel.
Everything King writes is that way, you know what?
Fantastic. You know, Salem's Lot is vampires that come to small-town America, and they begin wiping out these small towns one after the other, leaving a sort of a swamp destruction and ghost towns in their wake. And again, when Salem's Lot first came out, that was about the time when America was seeing the withering away of small towns and farming villages. So again, he's just sort of touching upon a fear of that time and then, you know, casting it in the vampiric light. And of course, probably one of the big vampiric books was Anne Rice's Vampire Lestat series.
Huge.
1980s. And during that period of time, it was, you know, time of AIDS was on the rise. Again, another plague similar to what we were talking about in the past. Only this plague was linked to, you know, blood, sex, and death, which is a predominant theme in her book. So again, her vampires were reflecting a major fear during that period of time. So even in my book, I tried to take that that same type of fear, this sort of the angst of what's going on right now about between science and religion, between logic and faith. Right now, we sort of draw a line in the sand between the two. And my novel, I try to rub that line down and play with that gray area between faith and science.
Well, do you think some of the authors, James, would look at events of the moment or of the era and then put them into their books like that?
I do. I mean, I think Bram Stoker did that. I'm sure Anne Rice did that. I think, you know, it might not do it consciously, but we're always looking for, especially novels, we're looking for that emotional way of moving a reader. And so there's something that sort of you're fearful of, something that's really disturbing you as a writer, you're going to try to incorporate that into your work.
Let's talk a little bit about these psychic vampires, first of all, people who draw on the energy of people, not the blood. I don't know which of the two is dangerous, more dangerous.
Right. The psychic vampires, they say that they're drawing on the pranic energy, the sort of psychic energy that's in us. And, you know, at this point, it's whether you consider that to be a scientific basis or not. I mean, there's definitely, I think everybody's been in the presence of somebody that after they're done meeting them, even though the person might have been very friendly, very outgoing, but you leave exhausted. It seems almost like they took something from you. You know, whether that is an active process or a psychological process, I don't know, but it's fascinating.
Well, when they grab this energy, whether they know it or not, what happens to the victim?
Well, yeah, it's a couple different theories from talking to some of these practitioners that believe that they are or know of a psychic vampire. Once you're separated from them, one or two things can happen. You can't actually recover your energy. Others believe that once that connection is made, that you can't break it. And they will continue to suck energy from you even after you're separated from them. There's that bond that gets established and can't be broken.
Why do we get sightings of vampires? James, how does that happen?
Again, you know, going to modern times, you know, we I think at this point, when we have this, you know, we have that the one gentleman that was consuming the homeless guy's face. You know, we have these striking, horrible things that occur, and I think we try to explain it away, and sometimes we do lean on the vampire mythology. I mean, if you go, you know, into the past, we see, you know, these different horrors possibly explained through vampires. For example, back, you know, again, being a veterinarian, I'm very familiar with rabies. In the furious form of rabies, humans have trouble swallowing. They drool heavily, often with bloody saliva. They're oftentimes aggressive or violent. They pass their disease by biting. Again, very sort of vampiric type of disease. But what's really intriguing about rabies, as you mentioned about, you know, the tie to garlic, and how
Yeah, how did that happen?
Well, garlic was often used at funerals because of its strong scent to mask the reek of the dead. And it came, gave rise to the belief that it gave protection against the undead. Now, in the case of a rabies sufferer, we do know that in the furious form of rabies, that these sufferers have a sort of an ultra sensitivity to strong odors because their nerve cells in the nose, throat, and larynx are being overstimulated by the rabies virus. So that sharp smell of garlic that is oftentimes around funeral sites, around cemeteries, would be very repellent to these rabies sufferers. Also, the most common vectors for rabies was, were dogs, wolves, and bats. Again, all creatures sort of tied to vampiric mythology. I think what we see, whether it's in the past or the present, when we see certain diseases that we can't quite explain, sometimes we will lean on mythology. It's not just even diseases. There's a medical condition known as porphyria. And this goes more toward the history of vampires being repellent or sunlight aversion. And porphyria, it's a rare disease, but there's a milder version of that. And I have a friend of mine who suffers from this called polymorphic light eruption. And it's like it's like a severe sun allergy, but it's actually not an allergy. It's an immune reaction against sunlight. And it causes severe light hypersensitivity. And these people, if they're exposed to any light, they feel excruciating pain, and their skin can bubble and break out in blisters. And again, in the past, where they didn't have sunscreen, they didn't have great protection against keeping out of the sun, this would be quite debilitating. One of the other symptoms you get with porphyria is it causes the sufferer's gums to deteriorate. Again, because the gums recede, it would make the teeth look longer. So here we have individuals who can't go out in the sunlight. They shun mirrors because of their risk of light reflection in the darkened rooms. They oftentimes will actually sleep in dark boxes to further avoid the daylight, which again would look much like a coffin. And of course, because they are avoiding sunlight, their skin would be extremely white. They had the gum deterioration, so the teeth would appear longer. Mm-hmm. And what's really sort of interesting about this disease is that the only relief these sufferers can get is a dose of enzymes that will give them relief. And what we found is that a lot of porphyria sufferers actually will have sort of a strong desire to want to drink blood, because blood does carry enzymes that can actually alleviate some of the pain and suffering. From
human blood or any kind?
Any type of blood. Generally, human is better than animal blood, but it can be either. So again, we see a lot of parallels between rabies and vampirism, between porphyria or this light eruption condition and vampirism. So I think that's one of the reasons we do see this persistence of this mythology, is that certain diseases and certain medical conditions can directly correlate to the vampiric mythology.
There was a couple of physicists did a paper.
Right.
Tell me about that.
Back to, again, I was. There's a lot of research is, can vampires be real? I looked about this, spoke to these people that believe that they're psychic vampires. I consulted this guy who was convinced that there's this endogenous retrovirus that can trigger vampirism. But also there's a pair of physicists wrote a paper in 2007. The paper was called Cinema Fiction versus Physics Reality, Ghosts, Vampires, and Zombies. The two worked out a mathematical formula to describe the number of humans left after so many months of vampirism. What they concluded was that if the vampire first appeared on January 1st of 1600 AD, that humanity would have been wiped out by June of 1602, about 2.5 years later. The paper concludes with, we conclude that vampires cannot exist since their existence contradicts the existence of human beings. It's hard to argue with those statistical facts, but, I do that in the Blood Gospel, and I still am not quite convinced that some of their mathematics makes sense to me, but it's interesting.
Nowadays, people are going to dentists, they're getting fangs put in, and, they're really into it, aren't they?
Yeah, I have a friend that has that done. Mostly he does it just as entertainment, but there are others that do believe that they fully latched onto the vampire mythology, and they will consume extra human blood. Others, like I said, believe that they're just more psychic vampires, so they're able to tap into others' energies and draw from it.
Where did the longevity of life come in on the vampires?
Well, I think that's a desire for again. I did a whole book on immortality with Bloodline, and we're always looking for what is beyond the mortal coil, so to speak, is, where are we headed to? When we die, where do we go to? So I think, we have scientists pursuing ways of exploring that. We have scientists pursuing ways of extending human life. But we also, I think, we have mythologies built around the fact that there are ways to survive after you die.
And they also tied this in where if you got bitten by a vampire, you too would become one. How did that happen?
Again, I think this goes back to the transmission of diseases in the past, where one person would catch it and die, and then shortly thereafter, because of the incubation of a disease, somebody else would die and it would pass on that way. Then again, it became more involved, where it wasn't just the bite of a vampire that transmitted vampirism. You'd have to be bitten by a vampire, nearly exsanguinated, and then you'd have to consume the blood of a vampire. So again, that again ties that line of blood really intimately. And even the Christian church, we start seeing all of the symbolism about the crosses and holy water repelling vampires.
Yeah.
And that believes that the mixture for Catholics, we believe that wine changes into the blood of Christ, and by consuming that wine during Mass, you get the essence of Christ into your body. And it's believed that even that has a vampiric history back in the Roman times, there was this belief that vampires did exist, or these creatures like vampires existed, and that Christ was a way of finding a path to salvation.
What about the stake through the heart? Where did that come about?
Well, that came about, again, mostly from the belief that two things. One, we can take a scientific approach, that they would find these bodies in these bloated states, and by staking them down, it would actually cause the bloat to dissipate, and so the body would deflate, and hence they would believe that they were letting the soul escape and that the vampire would be killed in that manner. Of course, again, the heart is the source of life, and then if they believe that these are the undead, if they really want to make sure they stay dead, was to place an iron stake. It wasn't just even an iron stake with iron, but different countries had different types of wood that worked best. In Russia, they believe ash wood is the way to kill a vampire. In other ones, it's hawthorn. There's a whole bunch of different ways of dealing with vampires, placing clumps of earth under the vampire's chin, placing a coin or stone in their mouth, tying a handkerchief tightly around their neck. So each country and each different culture seems to have a different way of dealing with.
Were people paranoid about all this, James?
Oh, I mean, it was quite rampant. I mean, at this point, they found in Ireland, they found a bunch of bodies that seemed to be dispatched in a vampiric fashion. I mentioned about in Venice, but also there were like 100 bodies were found in Bulgaria just recently that, again, were dispatched in such a manner that they believe that they believe these corpses were vampires.
All right, we're going to come back with more in just a moment on Coast to Coast AM.